Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. UPR is featuring periodic programs on voting and the political process as we move toward Election Day 2012. And today we'll check in on the candidates and the issues, we'll look back at the caucuses and conventions, and look ahead to the primary election. And we'll ask such questions as, why do people participate in our democracy? Why not? What are the main issues? Is the caucus convention system working? Such basic questions as, how do you register? Where do you vote? Which primaries are open? Which are closed? And we'll be speaking later in this hour with Deseret News columnist Frank Pignanelli and LeVar Webb, and with the state party chairman for the Democrats and the Republicans, respectively, Jim DeBacchus and Thomas Wright. In this part of the program, we're going to be talking with Kelly Patterson, director of BYU's Center for the Study of Elections and Democracy. And Kelly Patterson, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
And we'll also welcome back to the program Kirk Jowers, who is director of University of Utah's Hinckley Institute of Politics. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let me just ask a general reaction question to the caucuses and conventions, starting with Kelly Patterson. Anything that especially stood out to you?
Well, I think as an observer and not necessarily a participant in this process itself, I think what was interesting this time around was the large number of individuals who turned out at the caucus level, and then in turn, the types of delegates that were elected to the state conventions, particularly the Republican state convention. When you look at the different surveys and different measures of the individuals who turned out and who participated, there was much less emphasis on the Tea Party, much more emphasis on moderation, and I think a bigger turnout than what people surprised, than what people thought. So that was surprising.
Kirk Jowers, same question, just general reaction.
Absolutely echo Kelly. The best development was that the both parties did a great job of stressing turnout, as did a lot of other groups. A lot of other groups really felt like especially the 2010 caucuses and conventions were not representative of their overall voters, and as Kelly said, we did a pretty extensive survey with the Utah Foundation, which certainly showed that there were sometimes 25 point swings between Republican voters and their delegates. So it was much more representative, and I think that had a huge impact, of course, on the convention results. So I think that was clearly the big, and of course, probably the single biggest factor was the LDS Church's emphasis to its members to attend. I sat next to an LDS bishop, and he said, I read it over the pulpit the first time and didn't think a thing about it. After I did it the third time, I said, oh, I guess I better go to this thing.
Yes, I've talked to people who said that is the reason they went, is because their church emphasized that. Kelly Patterson, you agree with that? That's the single biggest reason why we had the big turnout?
I think that's a major reason why we had that kind of turnout. All the literature and political science, all the research seems to indicate that you need to motivate individuals to turn out to these kinds of events. Politics is time-consuming. It's rough on you personally because you have to go and rub shoulders with people you may not agree with. And all of those we find a little uncomfortable. So this system in particular, I think, places a tremendous burden on the individual. And to get over that burden, you have to animate that sense of civic duty. You have to connect it to their well-being and make sure that they understand that connection. And I think that's what the LDS Church has done in this case. And other churches and other groups, as Kirk has alluded to, you have to figure out some way to instill and then animate that idea of civic virtue to overcome some of the large hurdles and obstacles that are placed in people's way to participate.
I want to get into that. That gets us into a fundamental question. Why do people participate and why not? So, tell me about some of those hurdles, and I'll ask a similar question to Mr. Jowers.
Well, the first hurdle is time. It takes a great deal of time to learn about the candidate, to get yourself out of your house, to get the kids settled down with their homework or something like that so that you can get out and participate in a caucus. These are the same kind of hurdles that people have when they vote as well, although voting is not necessarily as onerous as participating in a caucus would be. Once you have that kind of that time issue resolved as best you can, then you have to overcome some of the discomforts, the personal discomforts that people feel about going and speaking in public and talking to somebody about something as controversial as politics. Talking about religion, talking about politics, talking about other kinds of controversial subjects makes people uneasy, and it's part of the psychological burden that participants feel. So you have to make that more comfortable for them in order for that participation and deliberation to occur.
Well, let me phrase it this way to Kirk Jowers. Even though we had an increase, a big increase, by all estimations in the caucus participation this time around, still a majority of people don't participate. And so I wonder, does that make you less hopeful about the whole process? How do we get more people to participate in our democracy?
Well, Kelly's exactly right. I think time, fear, uncertainty are amplified with our system. It certainly does cater to a certain type of person and leaves other people out. Some just because of these concerns, but some cannot participate for very real reasons. It's been fixed to some extent, but it used to be a big problem, people with disabilities, because sometimes these events were in homes or in places that were not ADA. Certainly LDS missionaries, service people, other people who are abroad on that very specific moment. You know, in our other elections, we have absentee voting and all sorts of other opportunities for people to vote, early voting. And so if you happen to be out of town, you happen to have your sons or your daughter's championship soccer game at that exact time, you're not precluded or forcing to make a very difficult choice. So that those are all problems with this. The biggest concern I still have, even with my kudos to everyone involved to getting the numbers up higher, and as you note, it's still a very small percentage who's doing it, but the trend was right, is that women still are grossly underrepresented. Even with this great turnout, women delegates were only 25% of the electorate, which is about a 30% underrepresentation of Republican women voters. And I haven't done any scientific studies on it, but anecdotally, you just kind of hear, and you certainly saw if you attended your caucus meeting, that a lot of times what happens is, it gets to be about time to go to the meetings, and even if they are very civic-minded as a couple, essentially they say, you take care of the kids, you watch the kids, I will go to the meeting, and usually the one who says, I will go to the meeting is the man, and so that's a fundamental difficulty. And by the way, Democrats are underrepresented with women by about 17 to 19%, so not much better.
Hmm. What are some fixes, do you think?
Well, a fix that I think would be great for Utah right now, which would be very incremental, is we keep our caucus convention system the way we have it. It does provide a forum for people. It does force candidates to kind of talk to well-informed delegates, but we provide an alternative route to the primary ballot. So we get to keep everything that we love about the caucus convention system for those people who love it, but we also guarantee another route to the primary ballot, and that would do at least two things. One, it would give us more primaries, which I think is a great thing because it engages more of the state. Candidates very wisely do not focus on anyone but that 2% of the population who are delegates. With the primary, everyone gets the messages and gets to consider the direction and vision of our leaders and our state. The other thing it would do is provide perhaps different people who would be more willing to compete on the primary ballot, and maybe not so much with the kind of closed atmosphere of the caucus. So I think that would be a great alternative. Keep everything we have and just add another one. And if you look at the states right now, there's about 45 states have a direct primary. Five of us have this caucus convention system. We are the only one that does not have an alternative route to the primary ballot. So we really are the outlier. There's no one else like us. And this would at least put us with the other five. We'd still be an outlier, but not quite as much.
Kelly Patterson, what are your feelings on the caucus convention system? Is it working? Does it need reform? Scrapped?
Well, whether it's working or not depends on what your normative goals are. And if increasing participation is one of the main priorities, one of the main goals, one of the main values that you cherish, then you've got to reform the system to maximize participation, because currently, as the caucus system is set up, it doesn't maximize participation. And as Kirk has talked about, there's so many different impediments and obstacles, and it really is costly. Economists talk a lot about costs and trade-offs and opportunity costs, and our system has quite a few of those. If your goal is deliberation, and if your goal is somehow ideological purity or something like that, then this is kind of a good system for that. If you're talking about specific party control, then this is a good system for that. But if you're really trying to maximize participation, if you're trying to maximize public involvement and accountability of elected representatives to a broader swath of the electorate, then Kirk's suggestion about alternative route to the ballot is probably the way to go.
If you just joined us, we're looking back at the caucus conventions, looking ahead to the primary election, part of a series of programs we're doing on voting and the political process. Coming up, the next segment, we'll have Deseret News columnist Frank Pignanelli and LeVar Webb. We'll conclude the program with the party chairman, Jim DeBacchus, and Thomas Wright, Democrat and Republican, respectively. Right now, we're talking with Kirk Jowers, University of Utah Hinckley Institute of Politics Director, and with Kelly Patterson, who's Director of BYU's Center for the Study of Elections and Democracy. If you'd like to join the conversation, we hope that you will. 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or you can email us at upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. Just a few minutes left in this segment. Kelly Patterson, I'd like you to expand on something you said early in the program. You're talking about how we get people to participate, and it does take quite a bit, you were saying, to get people over those hurdles. We've learned that one very solid influence is church urging. What are some other ways we can get people to participate?
Well, it is urging from organizations you trust. So when you talk about the LDS Church and its efforts to motivate individuals to vote, yeah, those are shown to be successful, not just here in Utah, but with other religious organizations. Another way to motivate people to turn out is convenience, making it easier for them to participate somehow, either through absentee voting or early voting, those kinds of things. They increase participation moderately. And then the other thing is to get competitive elections. Competitive elections require campaigns and political parties to reach out and touch voters. And it's those repeated contacts with voters that raises the profile of the race and the importance of the race in the minds of the voter, and helps the voter to overcome some of those obstacles that are perennially there. And like Kirk was saying, some of these obstacles are difficult to overcome. I mean, we're talking about now a very mobile and fluid labor force. So if you can only participate at one point during the day, at one day during the month, a lot of people aren't going to be able to get off work to do that.
Kirk Jowers, are there any recommendations from the Governor's Commission on Strengthening Utah's Democracy that have yet to be implemented or perhaps implemented as fully as you would like?
Well, from the Governor's Commission, some of them are not completely directly related to election turnout, but we feel like overall they would have an impact on our civic responsiveness. And some of those were reasonable contribution limits. Utah is, again, kind of an outlier there, one of four states that has no contribution limits. They have acted on a number of our proposals. We're seeing that with the military vote. That's why we kind of changed, the state changed its dates there to allow the military vote to be more meaningful. The big one, though, that relates to voting very directly is same-day voter registration. And Utah has very stringent rules on voter identification here, and so the likelihood of fraud under any circumstances is extremely low. And so Utah is very ripe to be a same-day voter registration state. And I think, at least the time we did it, I haven't checked in the last 2 or 3 years, but I think 6 of the top 7 voting states had same-day voter registration. And it goes to what Kelly said is, you know, when people, there are the political junkies who are probably watching this show who won't understand this, but for the normal person, it's very difficult for them to focus on it until a couple of weeks before, when the media and everyone, it starts churning, the candidates start putting out their ads and their mailers, and that's when they finally want to vote, but they can't register anymore. They don't know if they're registered, and they don't want to be embarrassed, but if they know, worst case scenario, they can show up, register, and cast a meaningful vote. That has a real significant influence.
Well, we've reached the end of this segment. By the way, vote.utah.gov is an excellent place to go. I went there just yesterday, put in my information. Luckily, I'm registered, but you can see where to register and how to register at vote.utah.gov. Excellent site. Kirk Jowers has been with us, director of University of Utah Hinckley Institute of Politics. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you.
And Kelly Patterson, who's the director of BYU Center for the Study of Elections and Democracy. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
And following a short break, we'll bring on Deseret News columnist LeVar Webb and Frank Pignanelli to continue this discussion on voting, democracy, look back at the caucuses and conventions, look ahead to the primaries, all on the journey to Election Day 2012, in November, of course. And later in the program, Democratic State Party Chairman and Republican Party Chairman Jim DeBacchus and Thomas Wright, respectively, will join us. Do stay tuned.
Coming up on the next Bluegrass Breakdown, just when you thought it was safe to come out of the water, we'll be plunging even deeper into the wild blue ocean. I'm Dave Higgs, and we'll be sailing on the wind, sailing to the promised land, sailing away to the west, and sailing away on wings of love on the next Bluegrass Breakdown.
Saturday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Utah Public Radio is featuring periodic programs on voting and the political process as we move toward Election Day 2012, and today we'll check in on the candidates and the issues, looking back on the caucuses and conventions, looking ahead to the primary election. Coming up, Party Chairman Jim DeBacchus and Thomas Wright, that'll be our last segment. Right now, Deseret News columnist Frank Pignanelli and LeVar Webb. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Appreciate you joining us again.
Glad to be here.
Let me give you each a chance to give a general reaction to the caucuses and conventions. At least on the Republican side, there was no shortage of drama. And I want to follow up with some comments that Mr. Webb made in the latest column, the Deseret News, starting with Mr. Pignanelli. Your general reaction to the caucuses and conventions?
Well, they were exciting. They were well attended. You know, that obviously came about because the precinct caucuses in March were so well, tenor flooded, actually, between all the efforts of the political parties, the LDS Church, and the community organizations. And so there was excitement there. What they did highlight for everyone is that the unique feature of conventions, which is they are governed so much by emotion and what happens on that particular day. And once again, in my mind, it does underscore is that is this really where we want to be selecting our candidates, is, you know, in this brief period of time, that you know, because whatever is the rumor or whatever is going on in the day. I mean, you had some great candidates because of their sheer charisma and their ability to attract candidates right there at the convention, whether it was Scott Howe in the Democratic convention or Mia Love at the Republican convention. You know, they were just, it was all personality. I mean, there's a lot to be said for that. The parties want to push candidates' personality, but at the same time, is that the best place? Is this the best process? And then, of course, you have whenever there's unfounded rumors and things like that, which played out in the 2nd Congressional District. So in my mind, it underscored, even though everyone was happy and it was exciting, it underscores the problems in the process.
Mr. Webb.
Well, I agree with some of what Frank said. The no process is perfect, and the caucus convention system certainly has its strengths that I would not want to lose. Emotion can also play a big part in an election, and sometimes the most recent things that happen just before a primary or general election or a electrifying speech or whatever can also have a big impact on that election. So, but when you have 4,000 people at the Republican convention confined in a space, and there's lots of rumors and discussion and talk going back and forth, it is certainly possible to develop kind of a herd mentality if someone gives a great speech or there's a major rumor going around. And so that is a little bit scary, considering that those 4,000 people are making decisions for the rest of the state, and sometimes a last-minute issue can sway a person in favor or in opposition to a candidate. But overall, the conventions were very successful, very well run. It's a difficult thing to logistically to operate a big event like that with so many people and all of them having equal votes. Some of them intend on doing mischief. So the conventions were very well run and overall had good results.
I want to have you expand on something you wrote in the Deseret News. This is, I think, your latest column. A quote from LeVar Webb: "The reign of terror of the Tea Party was eventful but short-lived." Reign of terror. I don't know if you've had any comments, pushback on that. That's a definite point of view. That's what you feel.
Well, certainly there were some people who weren't happy with that, and I was mostly being a little bit sarcastic there. But I also followed that up by saying that I think the Tea Party was important and played a very important role in kind of turning the tone of politics against big government and high taxes, and we were certainly headed that direction before the 2010 election, and the Tea Party was a grassroots uprising. It wasn't orchestrated from the top, and so I do think they played a very important role in kind of turning the political debate in the country around. I do think now that our citizens are focused more on problem solving and less on ideology, and I think that's a good as well, but I certainly would not want to lose the important lessons that the Tea Party taught us.
Frank Pignanelli, it was certainly a bad day for the Patrick Henry caucus. What do you make about that? Several of the candidates lost. There was infighting between a couple of members, Carl Wimmer and Steven Sandstrom. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, what is fascinating is the end. Well, you almost have to say it's the end of the Patrick Henry caucus. I mean, they might resuscitate themselves, but look at all the founding fathers, if you want to call it, the Patrick Henry caucus: Carl Wimmer, Steve Sandstrom, Assumption, and the week before Craig Frank went down. I mean, and then of course Chris Herod, who ran against Orrin Hatch. I mean, the founding, almost all the founding members of the Patrick Henry caucus are now out of office. Now, that doesn't mean they can't come back at some point, but that puts a real dent in that whole kind of movement. Now, having said said that, it's likely that the legislature will be, of course, will obviously remain conservative, not even more so conservative because of redistricting and things of that nature. But that just goes to show you that even though that they all may have agreed with the principles, that politics will always be politics, and the personal agendas and the personal ambitions, and there's nothing wrong having that, will always triumph oftentimes the ideology of any type of movement.
And Patrick Henry Caucus, for those who don't know, definitely for anti-federal government, for states' rights, those issues were definitely talked about and emphasized by some of the winning candidates. I wonder, in a general way, starting with Mr. Webb, sometimes we lose the issues in the horse race aspect. What were the main issues that emerged victorious at the conventions?
Well, certainly states' rights, federalism, as I prefer to call it, balanced federalism, was a really big issue. And all of the candidates are running against the federal government, and the legacy of the Patrick Henry Caucus, as some of those losing candidates have mentioned, lives on. Certainly in the last legislative session, there was a very strong states' rights element, and particularly with regard to federal lands. I mean, we do have now in statute, you know, that we're going to try to wrest control of federal lands away from the federal government, and everyone from the governor on down is supportive of that. And so that legacy certainly lives on, although that also existed before the Patrick Henry Caucus. So anti-taxes, anti-big government, federalism, those were all major themes in the conventions. And we certainly, in the Republican convention, despite the fact that a lot of the Tea Party folks lost and the kind of the ultra-conservatives, all of the candidates who emerged would describe themselves as strong conservatives.
Mr. Pignatelli, what are the issues? How is that going to be shaped as we go to the primary and general election?
Well, the issues, would be fascinating, because oftentimes in Utah, the things are a little more focused on locally, but it's all going to be the national perspective here. It's going to be, you know, we need to go back to Washington and the message, that type of thing. So it's really going to be a play out that way. Who has the best message on that? What's going to be interesting is how the Democrats respond, how they respond to Mitt Romney being on the ticket, how they respond to what's going to be kind of an anti-Obama fervor. And so they're really going to have a tough burden, and I think they can meet it, but they're going to have to come up with a message that really appeals to Utahns, because there's this belief that we do things right in Utah, and the state government, for the most part, has run well. Now, you're going to see some of the state candidates, whether it's Peter Cook or others, you know, say, wait a minute, there are some problems there, you know, with state government, whether it's the data breach or other things that are happening in state government. But the national issues really will play a predominant role this election, like almost like no other, especially because of Mitt Romney on the ticket.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Mitt Romney as the presumptive nominee, do you think that had any influence in some of the particular races?
Well, certainly Orrin Hatch tied himself very closely to Mitt Romney, and I do think that had some impact. Romney is enormously supportive enormously popular in Utah, and so the fact that he, in a really quite personal way, endorsed Orrin Hatch and now has asked him to be on his policy committee and so forth, I do think that has some sway with the more mainstream delegates that were at the convention.
Yeah, that I believe, along with LeVar, that played a key role for Orrin Hatch. And what's going to be interesting is that in the primary on June 26th, that's between Orrin Hatch and Dan Lillenquist. But see, Romney's going to be on that ballot too, and so granted, Utah'll be the last primary. The decision will obviously be made by then, but I think there's going to be a push to show we want to have a great turnout for Mitt Romney, and I believe that will help Orrin Hatch.
If you just joined us, we're talking about the political process of voting. It's part of a periodic series of programs leading up to Election Day 2012. Right now, Deseret News columnist Frank Pignatelli and LeVar Webb. Coming up, the state party chairman Jim DeBacchus and Thomas Wright will join us. I want to get a reaction from each of you to this curious incident that happened in the second congressional race, the Republican convention. A supporter of the eventual nominee, Chris Stewart, very close before the vote, made allegations of skullduggery. And in return, though not, I think, in front of the convention, but afterwards, the opponents of Mr. Stewart, in turn, alleged that this, in fact, was a plot on the part of supporters of Chris Stewart. Maybe starting with Mr. Webb, what do you make of all this?
Well, I was not there, but I have talked to a number of people who witnessed that, and it did have an impact on the results, and it was very confusing for delegates. The party has decided to investigate it and see if there was anything truly improper that happened. But it's a matter of, I mean, it gets a little bit confusing because the allegation is, of course, that someone was making such outrageous accusations against one of the candidates for the purpose of not hurting that candidate, but actually turning a tide of support for that candidate, you know, a kind of a reaction to the negativity that would actually help the candidate instead of hurt the candidate. And so that, you know, that all can really get quite confusing. Then there was also the fact that as one of the speakers was speaking quite negatively, he was allowed to continue with his speech. But when another candidate attempted to refute some of those things and was also speaking quite negatively, his microphone was cut off. So there was some feeling that among the delegates that was not handled properly, and that maybe there was some kind of party support for the speaker whose microphone was not cut off. And so it all got, you know, pretty strange. And again, in that, you know, with 4,000 people, or actually 1,000 in that particular congressional delegation, it really was a difficult issue. And I do think it ultimately had an impact on the outcome. David Clark was, of course, ousted, and he was expected to get into a primary with Chris Stewart, and so I don't know how many votes it may have affected, but without that, it's possible that he could have, David Clark could have gotten into the primary.
By the way, just to follow up, I'll have Frank Puttinelli give his take on this whole thing, but this is an example. I hadn't heard of Chris Stewart much before this. You know, you hear about your legislative leaders. I hadn't really heard much of Chris Stewart before the convention, and now he's the Republican nominee.
Well, and yeah. he did run a good campaign. I should add that he's a solid candidate. He did run a good campaign.
Okay, Mr. Pignanelli, your reaction. What do you make of this whole incident?
Well, first of all, let me allow me to praise Tom Rise, Republican chairman, because I was able to watch all this happening on my computer at home. They did live streaming of this, so which was really cool.
Yeah, using the technology.
I just sat there befuddled, just, you know, as these candidates stood up, and there was quite, you know, who was backing who, and then all of a sudden, Mayor Hanks, I think his name was, talked about, you know, all this, and they were calling Tim Stewart a liar. You could just see there was pandemonium even across the internet over this, and it just demonstrated how emotions in a convention setting and shift. I know what I felt bad about is that, and LaVar's right, Tim Stewart worked hard. Tim Stewart was actually leading in the delegate surveys, but he was nowhere near 60%. And you have Dave Clark, who you know, former Speaker of the House, fine elected official. And, I mean, and for him to be subject to some type of, you know, intense, rumor mill, right there, the heat of the moment, that he'd be—that's just who Dave Clark is, and that's what I feel bad about. That's why I really have serious reservations again about the delegate convention process. When you have good people like Dave Clark and others who just, you know, just the heat of the passion get dumped, you know, notwithstanding the hard work they have, that really is a time for us to relook at this. Tim Stewart played a role. I don't hold anything with Tim Stewart. I think you're right. He was ahead of the delegate polls. He knew what he was doing. I don't think had any part to do with this. It's just the emotion of the moment.
Mm-hmm. We should say Chris Stewart is the nominee.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Tim Stewart is his brother.
He's also been in the press.
Yes, who's also been in the press. Yes, and connected with this whole thing. LeVar Webb, you have said in the most recent column, the Deseret News, you generally support the caucus convention system, but modest reform perhaps is in order. What modest reform?
Well, I would like to leave the caucus convention system intact and let the party use that system and let those who want to go through that system to continue to do so. It does allow someone that doesn't have a lot of money, who's willing to work really hard, to get to enter into the political process. But I think there ought to be an alternative way to get on the primary election ballot, and that it would be, as most states in the country do, you have to go out and raise a certain percentage of signatures of those who voted in the last gubernatorial election. And if you're able to meet that requirement, and it's a difficult requirement, you can get on the primary ballot. What that would do is broaden the participation in the process. It would not allow a small faction, as we have seen in the past, an arch conservative faction control the caucus convention system. People who may not be able to win the support of the far right could still get on the primary ballot.
We are coming to the end of this segment. I want to look ahead to the primaries and to the general election. I wonder if you see any upsets in the making, or will it be as usual? Mostly Republicans get elected, specifically maybe starting with District 4. Jim Matheson, the incumbent, against Mia Love, who's a rising star on the Republican side, starting with Mr. Pignanelli in this one.
Well, and just as a teaser, LeVar and I are writing about this for next Sunday. The 4th District is absolutely fascinating to watch because, Mia Love is charismatic, and she is a conservative darling, and a lot of the Republican and conservative organizations are going to be funding her. But Matheson is a great campaigner, and Matheson has never made a mistake in his entire political career, and it's going to be a fun one to watch. And you're going to have to, although there's a lot of excitement about Mia Love, and it's well-deserved, you got to remember, no one campaigns better than Jim Matheson. And at the end of the day, it's his solid organization and messaging will have a resounding effect.
And this is a new district, right?
It's a new district, although a good chunk of the people had been represented by Jim Matheson before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. LeVar Webb, what's your take on this?
This race will attract a great deal of national attention. It has multiple great storylines, the possible first female black Republican House member in the nation's history, who also hails from Mormon country, and she's attractive and feisty, so this contest will make the top most exciting races to watch among the national pundits who do those things. It also features the possibility of a Republican seat pickup when control of the House, could hang in the balance. It's also the possible defeat for another blue dog Democrat, and they're becoming sort of endangered species, and it's the best opportunity the Republicans have had in 10 years to knock off Jim Matheson. So this will be the most interesting and exciting race in the state. I do think that it's sort of that on paper, Mia Love should win. All she has to do is hang on to Republican and Republican-leaning votes. But as Frank said, Jim Matheson is a very formidable campaigner. One of the things Mia Love is young, she's inexperienced, she's never done anything of this level. Her campaign really needs solid leadership. And if the National Party comes in and runs a highly negative campaign against Jim Matheson, I think that will backfire and hurt them because Utahns know Jim Matheson, they like him, and a scorched earth sort of campaign by the national political consultants from the Republican Party could hurt more than help.
Wonder about the primaries. We'll have Orrin Hatch against Dan Lilienquist, Republican primary for the Senate. In District 1 for Congress, or Democratic primary, Donna McAleer against Ryan Combe. Somewhat unusual, we'll have a primary for auditor, the incumbent Austin Johnson against challenger Representative John Dugal. And focusing on that, LeVar Webb, what's the beef? Isn't that kind of a non-controversial office?
Well, it is sort of a technical office. It probably shouldn't even be an elected office. It should be something that is appointed by the governor. But that is going to be interesting to watch. Austin Johnson is not a political guy. He's never had strong opposition in his previous campaigns. John McDougall is very political. He will have support of a lot of his legislative friends, and he will probably be able to raise more money, and he may run a more aggressive campaign. But Austin has the advantage of being the incumbent, so that will be a very interesting race to watch.
And finally, Frank Pignatelli, the Attorney General race, John Swallow, Sean Reyes, this is to succeed Mark Shurtleff. What do you make of that race?
Well, this is hotly contested. Both Mr. Swallow and Mr. Reyes have been out there. They've raised a lot of money. They're out there on the airwaves. They're very aggressive. Sean Reyes has support of a lot of the kind of legal community. He's worked for one of the large law firms. John Swallow, however, he's a former lawmaker, ran for Congress twice, almost beat Jim Matheson in 2002. He knows a lot of the players there, and so you would have to say that Reyes is doing a good job, Reyes. But it's probably Swallow's to lose. From everything I've seen, he's ahead in the polls, and ahead in terms of some of the other factors there too. But this will go down to the wire.
Well, the primary is June 26th. We'll all be keeping an eye on that, and I'm sure we'll be back talking about this after that primary. Thanks so much, Deseret News columnist Frank Pignatelli and LeVar Webb. Appreciate it.
Glad to help.
Thank you.
And following a brief break, we'll be on with State Democratic Party Chairman Jim DeBacchus, and we'll be joined, hasn't called in yet, but we hope to be joined by Republican Party Chairman Thomas Wright. And that's coming following a brief break.
Last week on Car Talk, we demonstrated our usual sensitivity to callers with serious car problems.
So it wasn't entirely my fault. It was coming as well.
No, it was your fault. But we love you anyway. I mean, it does. You know, everybody makes mistakes. You know, I teamed up with my brother. I mean,
I made that mistake. Don't miss the fun this week.
Join us for Car Talk.
Saturday morning at 10, Sunday evening at 5 on Utah Public Radio.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah today. We're talking politics. You probably were able to tell from our conversation so far this hour. And political process, voting, as we move toward Election Day 2012. This is a part of a periodic series of programs we're featuring on Utah Public Radio. We just had the caucuses and conventions. We're looking ahead to primary election. That's on June 26th. And there will be some primaries. Several candidates were able to get to that 60% threshold and will not face a primary election. But we will have a senatorial primary, Orrin Hatch versus Dan Lillenquist. On the Democratic side, Donna McAleer against Ryan Nacomb for the District 1 congressional race. And we'll have Republican primary races for auditor and attorney general. Joining me now is Democratic State Party Chairman Jim DeBacchus. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, it's always a pleasure. My favorite radio station.
Thank you. We appreciate that. Give me your general reaction to your convention. You felt it came off smoothly?
Well, unlike the Republicans, we just don't have the kind of drama that seems to follow the Republican conventions. We're boring, we're efficient, we get to business, we have our primaries, we're civil. Nowhere near as much fun as Thomas has with the Republican conventions and the delegates screaming at each other and all of the shenanigans and the drama. I mean, in a way, I wish maybe we did have a little more drama at our conventions.
You're hoping for a little more, not too much, but a little more drama. I want to ask you about your host prospects in November. One reason we talked about this in the first segment of this program with our political scientists, one reason that I've observed that people don't get involved in the process in very red or very blue states is because they don't feel their vote matters. It's just going to happen the way it always has. I believe you're more hopeful than that. What can you tell me to back that up?
It's one of the bad side effects of the problems that that we've had with redistricting over the last 30 years. Really, the Republicans have in our state have so manipulated the redistricting process, and they've put all the Democrats together, and they have made virtually every seat non-competitive, with a few exceptions, so that what happens is people don't bother to vote. They don't feel like it matters. And you see statistics like in 1980, we were fifth in the country in voting percentage, and now we're 48th. And it's because of this horrible gerrymandering and redistricting, which in effect disenfranchises Utahns as the Republicans get in those closed caucuses, start drawing all these maps, then march out and say, okay, that's the way it is. And it's quite disgraceful. And it has robbed the soul of our democracy by taking away any semblance of competitive races.
Now, Republicans will tell you that it's not so much the gerrymandering, but it's just a simple fact that Utah's electorate matches up better with the Republican platform.
Well, other than that not being true, I mean, take for example, Ogden City. Ogden City should have been one Senate district. But you have guys like Stuart Reed, the senator who represents there, not wanting to run against the two other Republican senators that were basically in the Ogden City area. So a Senate seat has 95,000 people in it. So that should be Ogden, but when you have to divide that by three senators to protect the three incumbents, it means you got to go somewhere if you're going to split up Ogden three ways to get those 95,000 people. So Senator Reed ended up splitting it up so that Ogden City now, 17th Street, shares the Senate district with Kimball Junction. Those people have nothing in common. They had to go across three other Senate districts. All of that is to protect their incumbency, and it disenfranchises all of the people there. And that's what's happened. It's had a terrible effect. And the smug incumbents who are there in the Republican group, they get their jobs protected. And meanwhile, we see democracy fizzling away. It's a disgrace.
By the way, we're talking with State Democratic Party Chairman Jim DeBacchus. We have invited Thomas Wright, his counterpart on the Republican side, to join us, and we hope that he will join us by the end of the program. If he doesn't, I should point out that last time we did a similar program, Mr. DeBacchus was the one who wasn't able to join us. So in case we get attacked for being one-sided here. Jim DeBacchus, what do you think are the main issues that you believe are going to resonate with Utah voters?
I think 27 years of straight, absolute Republican control have just led to a complete mess. I mean, the Republicans, this governor's a nice guy. He's just the kind of guy you'd like to have as a next-door neighbor. But he doesn't know what he's doing. He's way, way over his head. I mean, the Republicans talk continually about running state government like a business. If you had a business and 800,000 names and Social Security numbers and the most personal information was divulged, and it wasn't divulged all at once. It was over 3 weeks. And they got the information that the system had been breached. But the government is so incapable, the state government, of responding that thousands, tens of thousands of more names came out because it was so poorly managed. Or there's still that $13 million that bribe that took place on the UDOT. And now the Republicans, they still can't understand. The governor says, you know, I didn't know about it. The legislature says, I didn't know a thing about it. How can the head of UDOT write a $13 million check out and the governor doesn't know? No one in the administration knows? No one in the legislature knows? The legislative analyst doesn't know? How is that possible? How many other checks are being written? So there is, and you can just go down the list, item after item, of what a mess. Education, we continue to be 51st in funding. Our test results have gone from the mid-90s being 15th to in the mid-40s now. We're sacrificing a whole generation of kids. We need new leadership. These are kind of nice enough people, but they've been there too long. They have no vision. They've got no idea of where the state ought to be going. And we need guys like General Cook for governor and Scott Howell for the U.S. Senate. We got to shake things up around here.
Just to have a couple of minutes left, I know that one of the ways you're trying to expand the base for the Democratic Party is your outreach to Mormon voters. I wonder how that's going.
In really a remarkable show of support, the LDS Dems went from non-existent to our biggest caucus at the state convention. We have now, I think there was 12 or 1,300 LDS Dems there. And as the Republicans have gone further and further and further out to the extreme, where Bob Bennett is too liberal, there are a lot of Republicans, kind of thoughtful, moderate people that are going, is this my party? Is Mike Lee represent me? Mike Lee, who's voting against a good Utah attorney, for a judge because of some crazy constitutional idea he has in mind? The answer is the LDS Dems have and are making a tremendous influence in our party, and we're grateful to have them.
So June 26th is the primary. Democrats have an open primary, don't they?
Yes, they do. We do. We, unlike the Republicans, you have to take a blood oath to get involved in a Republican primary or to go to a Republican caucus. I'm not sure how much blood you have to give. We'll have to ask Thomas that. But we're in a party of openness. Our caucuses are open. Our primaries are open. Our legislative caucuses are open. Come be part of the Democratic process in the Democratic Party.
So a good place to go for information, general information, is vote.utah.gov. The Democratic Party website is utahdemocrats.org.
Utah Dems.
UT Dems.
.org.
Great. And you can Google the Republican Party. Constitution Party has candidates as well. There are several other parties. Get informed and get out and vote. Jim DeBacchus has been our guest in this segment of the program. Always a pleasure. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks so much. Love talking to you.
Thomas Wright was to have joined us. We'll get him next time. And earlier in the program, we talked with political scientists from U of U, Kirk Jowers, and from BYU, Kelly Patterson, and with Deseret News columnist Frank Pignatelli and LeVar Webb. By the way, on our website, upr.org, that's upr.org, we have a link to that voter information site. So if you have questions, what to do to register, what the deadlines are, absentee voting, early voting, how to register, all of those questions can be answered from our website, upr.org. Thanks for listening today.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.